The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is the Australian writer Christos Tsolkas, who was back in the UK last week promoting his new book Barracuda. We'll be hearing from him about that on this podcast later. This follows the repercussions from a suburban Melbourne barbecue in which a child gets slapped in public. Christos told Book Club Supremo John Mullen that he started out with a collection of narratives and no idea of how to string them all together into a novel.
I just thought I want to write something really simple about my experience, about contemporary Melbourne, this place I know. I want to write a book about something that's going on in my place, about how we've grown so very wealthy, we've grown so very privileged, and we've grown so very selfish at the same time. And I had a collection of characters. I wasn't sure that if this collection of characters actually formed a novel. I guess what I didn't know was whether I had a story. There was a moment that came as a gift, which was a moment at a barbecue at my mum and dad's place where an incident happened with a small child and my mum. And that's the moment where I thought, I've got the beginning of a story. And that means I've got the beginning of something that is a novel.
And what I didn't realise was that the child said to, was it your mother?
These were the exact words. Nobody has a right to touch my body without my permission. And Jack would have been maybe 3.5 when he said it. I've always been very, very clear, and I want to be really clear when I have told this account that it was the lightest of moments, guys. It was, you know, Mum was just being really frantic in the kitchen. There was a lovely day. There were, you know, the mother of the child was there with us. He just wasn't listening to her, and he upset all this stuff in the kitchen. And she literally just pulled him up like this. I'm going to do it to John, and just gave him the slightest pat on the back of his buttocks.
Nobody touches me.
You know, and we all laughed, and Mum was just, you know, she just scooped the child up in her arms. And I mean, it wasn't what occurs between Harry and Hugo. It is that moment of incomprehension. It's that look of incomprehension between this woman and this child that I couldn't get out of my mind as I was driving back home. I was working towards writing this novel about what did contemporary Australia look like, and it did not look like the Australia I saw on our screens, and it didn't read like the Australia in literature. It was much more complex and much more dynamic and stranger than that. My mother is a woman who grew up in a very patriarchal world where, because she was born a woman, because she was born a girl, there was never the chance of education. She grew up in a world that had just been blighted by a world war and then a civil war and by poverty, and she was Australian. And then there's this young boy who's grown up in a completely different environment, has got a sense of himself that I think is actually really important, but they inhabit the same space. And I just thought, that's the moment, that's how I can begin a novel.
Yeah. It does seem to be a book which, by its sort of very method, captures some really furious thoughts that people have, and that even the more pacific characters sometimes have. And I just wonder, you know, in the way at the end of the book, I thought, well, the slap is an expression of sort of unrestrained anger, but there's a lot of more restrained anger throbbing through everybody's head in this book.
And I'm not sure how much is an anger that is national, mm-hmm. you know, that there's something in what is occurring in Australia and was occurring at the time that is reflected in it. What I can say is that anger, aggression, has been a challenge for me from very, very early on. You know, how you deal with those demons, how you reconcile your understanding of what is ethical right behaviour with those violent, ugly, misanthropic or misogynist fantasies. That's an ongoing project. That's an ongoing part of learning to be adult for me as a man. There was an Australian critic, and she said what she enjoyed about the slap. I think she used the word enjoyed, but she also what was challenging about it is that it gave voice to the things men thought but didn't say. I mean, I'm very clear about what violence is, and that I think, you know, part of being adult is knowing and learning how to control those instincts and not giving yourself over to those instincts. And I was very deliberate that the novel would be bookended by a slap. There are two slaps that occur in the novel. And the second one, and the final one, which is the one Tracy slaps Richie, that comes from a completely different impulse. It comes from love. It comes from a woman who is desperately scared of what is occurring to her son, and she does it in a moment of desperation. I think anyone, whatever you think of the novel, who reads it, understands where it comes from and understands that there is nothing malignant, that there is nothing ugly in that slap. That's not the case with the slap that Harry delivers to Hugo. And I will laugh when people say, you know, if I was at that barbecue, I would have slapped that kid too. But the reality is, I hope no one in this room would have slapped a kid at a barbecue. Maybe, I mean, what Harry should have done, or someone should have done, is intervened with the adults and said, what are we going to do about this behaviour?
He's got a cricket bat in his hand, though, hasn't he? But you did up the ante, if that's the right cliche to use, quite a lot. First of all, by making Hugo quite obnoxious in certain ways. You know, maybe it's his upbringing, it's not his fault. You didn't have to put in the later episode when he's with Richie and he just gratuitously spits at an old man in the street and then kicks him. You must have made quite a cool choice there. So you're making it almost tempting as possible for a reader to think he deserved the slap almost, aren't you?
You got to remember what happens throughout a very shifting narrative. And part of the reason, you know, I chose to do this multiple voice is to, you know, what do you see that you didn't see before? Richie is the one character who has been supportive of Hugo all the way through. It makes a much more interesting story. It makes a much more interesting moment that he too is confronted with behaviour that is really ugly from this child. And how does he react? Mm. The slap is so far from autobiography, but that actually came from a moment in my life where I was with a child that I adore, who did spit at an older person. I remember the shame I felt, and I remember being so angry, and just so angry that I was scared that I was going to really do some damage to this child. And I remember, just as I describe in the book, just pulling him across and just holding on to him, and he's screaming because I'm probably hurting him, but I just knew if I stopped I was going to hurt him. And then something broke through and I heard his cries, and I just hugged him.
It's quite interesting that traditionally, I suppose, the business of multiple viewpoints has been, you know, when I know literary critics will tell you, oh, George Eliot, she does it so that you've got to sympathise with everybody. You discover everybody's got their story. You sympathise with everybody. But in a way, with the slap, what you do is you discover that most of the characters, or at least some of the time, are not kind of more sympathetic than they appear, but less sympathetic than they appear. You know, because you discover, which is the gripping thing, the bad things they're thinking, even if they don't do them.
You know, I was writing this book at a time when I just felt the world around me was, as you know, was becoming increasingly selfish. It was becoming increasingly materialistic. It was becoming, at the same time, less kind and less generous, even though it had all this wealth. And the other thing it was doing, it was becoming less honest. It's always been clear to me, my favourite characters are Manolis and my favourite characters are Connie and Richie. Absolutely no accident that they are not my generation. because it's my generation that has proved to be the selfish generation. It's my generation that has proven to be the materialistic generation. At the same time, though all of that is completely true, I thought one of the challenges as a writer was to see if I could carry you guys as readers through people who were not sympathetic all the time, who were disloyal at times, who were hypocritical at times, who were ugly at times. I'm very, very clear that, you know, even when I began working on the novel, it's set in a suburban terrain, you know, and I think that there's always been, you know, that fear of the suburbs. It's so banal, it's so boring, you know, can anything interesting come out of the suburbs? And I just thought, I'm going to challenge that. And I've, you know, I said from the beginning, it's going to be neighbours on acid.
Well, there's quite a lot of drugs. There's quite a lot of drugs in it.
What is happening in the suburbs is ugly and boring, but there's also exciting things happening in the suburbs. The reality in Melbourne is the inner city is getting more and more gentrified. It all looks the same, it all sounds the same, everyone's got the box set of The Wire. The place I live, when I moved there 13, 14 years ago, I'd do this walk down to the creek and I would pass this school, and it was... they were just kids from the five continents, you know. They were the little Arab girls, and they were, you know, kids from all over. And I just thought, I really like this place. And, you know, I take the walk down, you know, a few months ago, and it's all blonde kids whose parents are professionals and academics. And it's not now until you go right out that you go to schools, and that's where they speak, you know, 55 or 75 languages. And I thought, it would be interesting for someone like myself to look at this suburban world and reflect on it. The really big shock of what has happened at the Slap is that I'm here in front of you guys in England talking about this novel. You know, so the question I have is, how does this, what seemed to me such a very Australian novel, not even Australian, such a very Melbourne novel, how is it that it resonates here in the UK? How is it that it's published in so many places? And what does that say about the middle class? I wasn't sitting down at my desk going, how do I write a bestseller? You know, I was writing the book I wanted to write. It's much more interesting to write about, you know, characters who are ambivalent. I had done things that I was so ashamed of. I knew what it was not to have the courage of my convictions. I wanted to give a sense of what that was like. I wanted to give a sense of how difficult relationships are, how difficult family is, how difficult remaining loyal is. And I think that that's actually a much more interesting kind of literature, at least in my experience of reading. I'm not only a writer, I'm also a reader. And also, you know, I was thinking about my nieces and my nephews and the kids in my life and thinking that maybe they won't be as selfish. Maybe like they will be different to who we are. You know, to be honest, I don't actually feel very positive about my country at the moment, because I feel like we have become, you know, that meanness and unkindness that generated the Slap. It just feels like it's getting even worse, from our treatment of refugees to so many aspects of our politics. But given that, I'm trying to remain really hopeful about that younger generation, that maybe something will occur that will be different to us, you know. And so I just thought, that's how I'm going to end the novel. I'm going to end it with this high.
Literal high. It's
yeah, a literal high.
Well, it's past time when I should give everybody here the chance.
When did you start realizing you had the talent? Did you want always to write, to be a writer? Did it come just because of the developments in the Greek community and the overall atmosphere in Australia? The second thing, what was the reaction within the Greek community in Australia to your book? And also the response from Greece on the book itself.
This is not my memory. This is my mother's memory of me being at we're waiting for the tram in Melbourne, and she said that out of the blue I had looked up to her and said, "Mum, you know, Mama, I want to be a writer." You know, and that I was maybe 9 or 10. I've often told the story, but I'll tell it till I die, because it says something about the kind of man my father was. Like, he worked at a factory close where we lived, and every Thursday was payday, and he would get, you know, in those days, the little yellow packet, and he would go to a bookshop on his way back home from work, and he would buy me two books, you know, and that, you know, just because he loved the fact that his son loved to read, you know. The Greek community in Australia is now so diverse that I don't know if I can speak on behalf of one voice, but I think The Slap was a popular book, and I think there were a lot of people who went, oh, thank God, you know, I can read about an Australia that I recognise.
I'm Australian, and I read both your books and Barracuda as well in London, and I've never heard anyone speak about Australia like that. I was amazed. I wanted to delve more into how Australia reacted to your portrayal of the Australian. Did you find that everyone was nodding their head, or were people saying, that's not us at all?
People will come up to me and say, really, really hated this character. Really hated this character. And I often walk away going, oh, you're exactly like them. I worry that we don't recognise the anger. The kind of the danger of parochialism, which has always affected Australia, makes us blind to what's occurring. I think, of course, there are people who recognise that this isn't Christos Tsolkas writing some kind of damning indictment of Australia that isn't ground in truth.
That really struck me reading it. You know, it was just everywhere. This kind of the language was very, what you could see as offensive from the outsider's eye, but perhaps within the framework of the characters and their lives just seemed to be somehow normalised. So I wonder if you could say a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the language stuff is really fascinating. So I'll talk about the term WOG, which is, you know, is I know is really controversial here. That was basically the term that was applied to the post-war World War II immigrants who arrived in Australia. It didn't really matter where you came from. You're a WOG, the other term was Dago. Was something happened in the 80s as I was becoming adult, which was a generation of us started reclaiming those terms. And part of that was a kind of bolshiness. Like, well, part of it was being really influenced by hip-hop culture. Yeah, I think Australians are casual in a language that's different to over here. That's actually one thing I don't really mind, the casualness, the kind of directness sometimes of, at least with an Aussie, you know where you stand. Whereas, I mean, don't get offended sometimes. I'm just not quite sure.
I just wanted to say that I feel very proud to be here this evening as a Greek Cypriot born over here in this country. Is that we call ourselves BBCs. British-born Cypriots. And you're what we call AB... Well, you're actually ABG, aren't you?
Yes.
Just totally wanted to congratulate you and thank you for your wonderful outspokenness, and also ask you about the fact that you talked about your very briefly mentioned the homosexuality side, and the fact that within our community, I know it's a very difficult thing to be out and Greek.
The sexuality stuff, of course, it was hard. I didn't even know the word in Greek for homosexual. So when I came out, I had to use the word pusti, which is the same as the word faggot, because that was the only, you know, mamaimi pustis, you know, like, because I didn't know how to say it. And why I'm concentrating on the word is because, one, I'm a writer, and I think in words, but it also says something about language. I had grown up with, fortunately, coming into adolescence at a time when second wave feminism, gay liberation, a whole series of progressive movements suddenly articulated a politics that made being homosexual, being lesbian, made it possible. But my parents were not part of that language. They couldn't read the Australian press. They couldn't understand the news. Those movements, very, very important movements, didn't bother to... They didn't speak to those communities. So the forging of a language about sexuality was a project that my parents and I worked on together. Through it was incredibly difficult at times, but it happened, you know, and I feel very, very fortunate about that.
Who are you most like in the book? Which character is most like you?
To be really honest, there's probably, you know, elements of myself in all those characters. Definitely, definitely. At my best, I hope I've got a bit of a Nook in me. I fear that I have a lot of Hector in me.
I was intrigued by what you said earlier about sort of being envious of Manolis's code of honour and how you wished you had that. And I was intrigued because Manolis's code of honour seems to get him into quite a lot of trouble. So he stands up with his brother's or sister's son just because he feels he has to, even though he doesn't necessarily agree with him. And you see his wife struggling with the honour of the community when her child gets divorced and how she can't even leave the house. And I was wondering whether if what you were missing was the certainty of what to do, whereas the younger characters are really struggling with what to do. Anouk and Anisha don't know whether to support Rosie, and they don't know whether they shouldn't. And similarly, the younger teenage characters are trying to work out how to protect their friends and how to live truthfully. And so I was wondering why you feel...
Yeah, look, you've actually articulated exactly what it is about... what I mean about honour. Because it's such a strange word. I felt for a long time... You know, I still struggle with the meaning of it, but that's exactly right. No, not that I support that traditional patriarchal system of honour that Manolis and Kula are enmeshed in. And, I've seen what results from that. But that certainty of an ethical code, of what is right, how to be good, not being able to be sure of anything, that's... I understand why that questioning is there, but it is a really difficult way to live, you know. And I guess it's that certainty of a code that I'm asking about or wondering about, and I think is important. And it's almost like I feel like we have to create a new kind of language to express that. Part of what did influence me was starting to work in schools, and I began a diploma of education when I remember this fierce argument in the classroom about discipline, and part of the fierceness and anger and was that we didn't know what words to use. We were really suspicious of the word discipline, but we didn't know what to put it in place. And then you were going into these schools, and they were really, you know, kids who really needed a surety, and we couldn't give it because we didn't have a language for it, and that's what I'm fearful of.
What I wanted to ask you was, you said before that you're a big reader, so I wondered what writers you felt had influenced you the most or that you enjoy reading the most. I did read your piece about Graham Greene, but I wondered what the writers you felt had been an influence.
Really big influences were people like Philip Roth. When I was growing up, Carson McCullers, Norman Mailer, I think people like Roth, that Jewish American generation who were second and third generation themselves, spoke to me of an experience that I wasn't finding in Aussie literature at the time. So I kind of completely saw myself in those novels. Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man. I had the most wonderful English teacher. An English lit teacher, Mr. Javier, who was a Czech refugee to Oz, and he introduced me to European literature, to people like Tolstoy and Stendhal, the great novel that fell into ill repute, but I keep returning to. I think there is something. Twain as well, and. Something I've always liked about the Americans is that they took English and ran with it. Kind of they created it anew. Always loved that about the Americans, and because I think Australia is still stuck in the colonial moment, we still haven't resolved that. We haven't quite done that yet.
Well, I know there are some other questions, but Christos shares one thing at least with me, which is that he didn't have a drink before these things, but he He's very, very keen on having one afterwards. Well, that's me. And I'm sure you would all, on all of our behalves, want me to thank Christoph very much for talking to me.
Thank you, John. Thank you very, very much, and thank you to you, John.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.